If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I mean, you could have a solid gold brick house overlooking the bay and never get it rented because your people suck. Or you could have a, you know, 8x8 U-Haul box sitting on a street corner. And if you got a great team, they'll keep tenants in that some bit.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you allowing me to come on and be part of it.
Oh, man, this is great. The pleasure's mine. You know, if you can give our listeners just a quick bio on yourself and who it is we're talking to today.
Well, the quick bio, sometimes the hardest part, right? Because you get to where you're thinking back, how did I get here? And I got here on a long, treacherous, ugly trail. But more or less now, just to kind of give you an idea of what I do today, you know, other than being a father and a husband and all those awesome things. When people want to ask about the business side of it, I finance investment real estate. And it's usually your conventional, you know, Fannie Freddie stuff, single family, duplex, triplex, fourplex, right? And so up until this point, it's been building that up since about 2003. I got in this industry in 1997. And this last year, I mean, we've always been growing, especially these last 5 years, compounding our growth. But this last year, I was blessed to close 1,332 transactions for real estate investors to, I mean, when you look at it, it's about 6.17 every working day for a total of 168 million this last year, which was absolutely awesome. Yeah. And so we're looking at this year, compounding that into 200 transactions a month. And then we get this punch in the gut from the U.S. Treasury dictating to Fannie and Freddie that 7% of your total portfolio can be investor and invest in vacation homes. 93% of the loans that Fannie and Freddie have in their portfolio have to be owner occupied. So never in history has that ever been done. And I know that they were running at 13 to 15% typically. So how they're going to cut that in half? What we're seeing is they're just cutting everybody off to get their percentages down. What they're doing with that and why they're doing, I have no clue. But that's basically who I am today. How I got here was a long range of worked on a cattle ranch in high school with the family, then worked in the oil fields and ran heavy equipment and drove truck. And then I worked in the mines in northern New Mexico till that got shut down. And I forced up my way into this by the grace of God through some really, really cool circumstances.
Wow. Now that's, we got a lot to dig into there. Let's start just first of all, are you dealing with mostly single family rental properties or is it that plus, I know you said up to quadplexes, you're doing bigger than quadplexes?
They come up here and there and I've got connections with folks, you know, commercial brokers that I plug them into it. I don't personally work those deals. I used to. What I found is when I tried to be everything to everyone, I became nothing to no one. So I decided to become very, very concentrated on what I work on, which is the 1-4 unit and working in the conventional banking world because the conventional banking industry has screwed that up badly. And so when you find a niche that the rest of the world sucks at and you can become really good at, it tends to become it really an opportunity for you to be something that nobody else can duplicate. And there's others that are trying and they're doing a great job, but you know, there's only one Aaron Chapman and there's only one team of mine out there that is like us. And I tend to try and make what we do so steep, so treacherous, so rocky, so covered with poisonous serpents that nobody wants to follow us where we're going because what we do is too damn tough.
Got it. When you say conventional lending has screwed up the 1-4 unit, what do you mean by that?
Well, so when you talk to the bankers out there, you walk into, you know, credit unions, regular bank, you start talking about wanting to buy 5, 6, 7 properties, that person on the other side starts to freak out because they don't know how to get that done. It's a rather daunting, especially when a person walks in with business tax returns. Again, you've got a person that starts to backpedal really quickly and it's like, oh, we don't do that. Well, yes, they do that. They do have the capability to do that, but it's hard. It's a very difficult process to do and nobody wants to take on hard. They'd rather, when you've got 3 people in the line that are extremely hard, but you got 15 people in line that are very easy, you're going to lean towards the 15 people. And the other part of it is those other 15, they're buying owner occupied. So 9 times out of 10, they're going to be a higher loan amount, right? Why would you not want to take an average loan size of $250,000 versus, which is a W-2 person versus a self-employed person buying multiple properties at say $70,000 to $125,000? It's 3 times the work for 1/3 the income. Why would you do that? Well, we do it because we built an engine that continues to take care of itself. because I have a really amazing staff that has a lot of experience, and the experience is in this field because this is all I focused on. Was it easy up front? No. Did I catch a lot of headwind from not only my corporate folks, where I'm at now and everywhere else I've been, but it's also just for the industry as a whole, and just the income itself was really meager when you're trying to build this out. But once you get it built and it operates on its own, man, it's amazing what you get.
What do you think is going to happen to your business with this 15 now going to 7% cut?
We're going to have to get more creative, which we already are. You know, we're scrambling like crazy to open up new channels of capital. And the one thing that we do have that I don't know that everybody else has is, since I concentrated on this so heavily, the single family investor, duplex, triplex, fourplex guys, these conventional loans, you know, initially back in 2016, we had a massive audit go on in our company between, you know, Freddie and Fannie coming in auditing all these files, which really freaked out the board and freaked out the company to the extent that they had to decide whether or not they want to back this guy up who wanted to write all these types of loans and focus on this particular type of business. And then they did decide to back me up and follow along with it and do these type of deals and make sure that I had the capability. Well, and Fannie and Freddie were done with their audit after, I think it was nearly a year. And I think they looked at nearly 600 files, if not more. They walked away saying, you know, everything's good. We don't like how you're doing this and this with your appraisals, or fix this, and we're okay. So everybody's like, wow, I mean, we really have a good product. And then I asked them to start tracking something, which I knew they tracked it, but they never really looked at it, where I was being taken to the airport by the president of the company. And he said, and he starts explaining to me the dilemma that they're in. I said, let me ask a question. This company does a ton of first-time buyer loans, right? He goes, correct. I said, what is the percentage of those first-time home buyer loans that you have delinquencies? Not just default, but what is just people going late within the first year or 2 years? He goes, I bet it's probably double-digit percentage of people having just late payments, because that's the nature of first-time home buyers. I said, okay, what is the percentage of mine that go late within that first year? I'll probably check, but I'll bet you I can count it on one hand what that percentage is. I said, well, check it out and let me know. Well, I said, and I have one more question. How often are you being audited on first-time home buyers versus investors? He goes, we're not ever being audited on those. I said, so you're never being audited on first-time home buyer loans, but you have a higher default rate and delinquency rate on them, yet I have a very low delinquency rate and a low default rate, if not non-existent on the default side, yet I'm being audited and beat to death. So I'd really like to know those percentages. He went back and looked, and we've seen those very, very recently. At the time, he had looked at several hundred files. You know, we're talking about double-digit percentage on one side, but for me, they only found two borrowers that had a late payment, two. And one of them was due to an issue internally, not with the client. So like, guys, we have very, very clean capital here, and we got very, very clean business here, and they've continued to evaluate that. And we as a company have the lower end of the market as far as delinquencies or defaults. We have we beat the national average. And then I crush that average with my pipeline because they track it. I think nearly 10% of the pipeline is my loans. What we saw is 9 point something. And I have very, very, very low default or delinquency rate, extremely low. So the paper's really good. The performance is awesome. Somebody's going to want this, and somebody's going to find the value in it. And there are people coming up, but it's just taking time for them to adapt to this mess that we're in right now.
When you say someone's going to find value in it, what do you mean by that?
Oh, when we're talking about, say, like a probably like, well, let's put it this way. You're familiar with the jumbo loans out there, right? You know, there's a lot of people living in California. They're not using Fannie and Freddie. There's a lot of people in New York, Massachusetts, Washington State, Virginia, many places in the U.S. that it exceeds the conforming loan limit. That's not being sold to Fannie and Freddie. It's being sold to somebody, right? There's banks out there. There's funds out there for different pools of mortgage-backed securities that are funding these deals. It's not our personal capital. Well, as a result of that, that's been carved out, and they found value of that. In that, they're definitely going to carve out other spots for value, you know, finding the value in the investor loans, and they'll start buying that on the secondary market. There'll be pools being created on Wall Street for these things because they're not going to be absorbed by the agencies like they used to be.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting because we haven't seen the repurchasing, or have we? Like you're saying, like they do on the and I'm talking out of my league here, so I'm correct with any stupid thing I'm saying. but we haven't seen the repurchasing.
Repurchasing, how do you define repurchasing? Because I hear the word repurchasing, that means we as our banking entity, Security National, have to buy back from Fannie and Freddie.
No, I hear those then getting sold off to secondary and other markets where people are saying, okay, we're going to repackage these investor loans, because you're saying that there's great value in those loans because the default rates are so low. Mm-hmm. Right. And so unlike traditional mortgages, which you're getting sold off on, you know, via like, you know, mortgage-backed securities, like you're saying, that's not yet happening with these, or is it?
Oh, it is. It's they're already being created. They're kind of slow in their, I'm saying slow. It's just really just happened in the last 2 weeks, right? When this whole thing came out, I believe they've been cooking this up for a while, but it just barely came out. It's just going to be a little bit of time before the market really starts to absorb how they're going to put it into use, where they're going to sell them, and who's going to be the end buyer on this paper. But there's definitely buyers for it. It's no different than, you know, you've seen the movie The Big Short, right?
Sure.
So it talks about the guy who paid the mortgage-backed security. There's always somebody to try and take these instruments as long as they believe they're going to make a return on it. Well, this one should be a triple A rated security, because one, it's secured by real estate. It's got high down payment. You got high chance of payment. You got very, very low default rate and very, very low delinquency rate. So that paper should command a lot of demand by the secondary market or by Wall Street. And those securitize it the same way Lou Ranieri did. And what Lou Ranieri realized, when you look back at that, prior to that, it was the local banks, right? You'd have a couple little local banks within a small town that was taking all the deposits of all the people in town. They would lend it out to the same people in town for their houses, for their farms and their cars. And they would pay them back then pretty substantial interest on their checking account, their savings account, their CDs, and they were making the margin, right? So they may charge 17% on a house loan and 22% on a car loan, but they're paying the person for their checking account, say 3%, and their savings account 5%, and a CD 8%. So making good money on those accounts, but also the bank was making awesome money on the exposure for the debt. And then, of course, when you have a crisis in an area, the bank ends up having that problem and they can't quite secure those funds. That's when the FDIC would insure them. Right. So that's where you had the whole savings and loan debacle and all that kind of thing, because they didn't have that insurance to be able to build it up. It's no different when it comes to what Lou Ranieri decided. Right. Person puts their money in these mortgage backed securities pools. It's no different than putting into the bank. And then they would lend it out based upon certain guidelines that they create. Well, Fannie and Freddie came along and said, hey, we'll play the bank. We'll play like we're the bank. We will create the guidelines or the criteria by where you'd lend it out. And then we'd guarantee it just like the bank. And whoever put their money up into these pools, it's no different than them having a checking or savings like it did back in the old days, right? So their money is sitting there guaranteed at a certain flat rate of return. Fannie and Freddie then get to get a piece of it because, hey, we'll guarantee that note. And whoever then is the securitizes it, puts the money to work, they get a little piece of it for servicing the notes. So it's a long drawn out trail of people. And as long as it performs, there's always going to be a market for it. We just have a major knee-jerk reaction today in the market where the market interest rates jumped up quite a bit. A lot of clients were shedding tears over the fact they can't get a 3.5% on investment property today. It's going to go up into the fours. But what I've explained to all of them, if that's what you have, you are owned because the rates are low, then you're not an investor. You're an opportunivore. Well, your opportunity is gone. If that's the case, you go ahead and leave, and the line shortens for real estate investors to be able to take advantage of the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So I wonder what the fallout or what's the entrepreneurial solution to, you know, Fannie and Freddie shoring up their books and cutting their loans to investors going to be?
Well, I think it's just doing no different than what the jumbo market did. It's having, you know, creating an appetite out in the market for really good paper. And what it boils down to is me as a real estate licensed loan originator with a really, really good team, making sure that every bit of business we do is good business. You know, we don't take chances on the deals. You know, the qualifying process I put my clients through is rather expensive for me if the client doesn't go through with the loan. It cost me a couple $100 to get these done up front, just with the hours we put in to ensure that the person we're doing the loan for can reasonably get that loan, and we're going to be secure as the lender, right?
Right.
So that, if long as I maintain that high standard when it comes to who we fund the loans for, I believe we'll always have a place to park those. If I was haphazard and just went about closing any loan I could just so I can have my numbers up, then I think that I would be worried today. Well, I'm not worried. I have too good of a pipeline of people. Now, could it still blow up? Sure, it could blow up. That's business. But I don't plan to slow down whatsoever. We continue to try and build our market share and make sure that we have the best paper available for those who want to invest in mortgages.
That's amazing. That's very cool. So tell me some things that investors could be doing better that they aren't when they approach you for getting a loan on a quadplex.
Well, for the most part, I think it would just be realistic about where the real value in this deal is. Too often, people are looking at pro formas and cash on cash return, and that gets them excited. And then they get in there and actually start seeing the performance of the deal after a loan is locked and what their actual payment is going to be and their actual rents are going to be. They start to freak out. It's like, man, this is not as good as my pro forma was. Well, it's because they fail to understand that pro forma is basically a Greek word for bullshit. It's not a real statement. A pro forma is something people make up based upon what they believe the performance would be, right?
Sure.
So when people hang their hat on something that has yet to occur, they get themselves disappointed. So what I explained to many folks is that the real value in the real estate, your single families, duplex, triplex, fourplex, is the ability to finance it for 30 years. That's where the value is. And I like to go over a little bit of math with people to explain that. And if you are good with that, I know you got a pen. You want to do some real simple math with me, explain to your audience why. So we're going to set some baselines for this math, okay? So we're going to say that let's say it's a $100,000 acquisition. You're going to put 20% down. You're going to have a 1% rent to value ratio, $200 a month in cash flow with a 30-year fixed loan. Now, that's all the formula for a single family. I'm going to go with the least attractive deal, okay? Does any of that seem unreasonable to you?
Not particularly, no.
The only thing that people might say might be slightly unreasonable is the 1% rent to value ratio, because now they're seeing a 0.89 or 0.85 or something like that. And I said, well, that's why I have it at 2%. I mean, at a $200 a month cash flow, because that seems more reasonable for a lower rent to value ratio. But I'm going with the 1% because it's easier to round the numbers. So with that, so let's say what I tell everybody when I start working with them, if you're going to get into this world, you got to change your mindset. Instead of being a consumer spending money and going into debt, you're now the CEO of your startup real estate investment business. And this business is basically setting up little franchise, one little property at a time, its own standing business. So we're going to talk about business based on those numbers you have there. So when we're talking about these funds here and this particular type of deal that we're referencing as far as the numbers are concerned, what we're going to say here is if you did your job as the CEO of your real estate investment business and you bought a property that you think will stay reasonably rented for the entire time you own it, have minimal capital or at least capital expenses on trying to maintain it, right? That maintenance costs are low. And you keep people in there for that period of time. Who's really paying off that $80,000 loan?
Sure, the tenant.
The tenant, correct. So let's take that. This is where the math starts to kick in. We're going to take that $80,000 loan. We're going to divide it by 30 because that's how many years it's going to take your tenant to pay it off.
Yeah. So what do you do? So two and two thirds.
Divide by 30.
Yeah, two and two thirds.
So $2,666.66 to be exact.
Okay.
So that means over 30 years, they're basically increasing your 20%, which was $20,000, by $2,666.66, which is equal to 13.33% of the original $20,000 every single year. Now, how many people's investments are growing by 13.33% of the investment itself every single year?
Sure. Not many.
Not many, right? That's one side. So we see that growth right there just in the fact that you bought correctly and you thought correctly and you acted like the right CEO buying your business. Now, that we figured out that growth. Now, let's take the loan itself or the cash flow itself. So now we've got a $200 a month cash flow. And that's based on $1,000 a month in rent, correct? 1% rent to value ratio?
Right.
So we get to raise rent because of inflation, correct?
Well, yeah, the inflation plus maybe demand generators or, you know, whatever else is going around there, why people want to live there. I mean, there's that too. But
exactly. Several different things are going to drive that. You know, inflation is one of the drivers. Do you know what the rate of inflation is today?
Well, real or what they print?
Well, what's the printed? And then we'll get into the real.
Yeah, it's somewhere. I mean, what is it? 2% or something like that. I mean, it's probably even less than that on what they say it is. But I mean, you do any sort of calculations otherwise.
Between 2 and they're claiming between 2 and 3 right now, basing it on the CPI and the PCE, right? Consumer Price Index and Personal Consumption Expenditures Index.
Right.
Both names would make you think that they're really monitoring what we're spending our money on, but we know for a fact they're not. The claim is that food costs are too volatile. Energy costs are too volatile. We don't look at all segments of housing, and we sure as hell don't factor in taxes. So when you look at all these things, our inflation is more than double digits. And I encourage everybody to go to the Chapwood Index. It actually talks about Tennessee, Memphis. It's saying it's that 9% inflation. You get to the Shadow Stats, which is John Williams' website. You're looking, they will show the difference between real inflation and the CPI and the PCE, which supposedly is trending downward. Right now it's trending up. But when you start looking at all that they're doing, we're looking at 10%+ across the nation. Yep. So what I tell people, it's like I factored at 7% because I don't spend money like your average consumer. I'm an investor. I'm a business person. I only spend on things I get to write off. So when you consider that I'm going to say 7%. So because of inflation, let's say we can raise rents 3% per year. I'm looking at the national average at about 3.6 to 4%. And I know Memphis is actually higher than that. So if you've got $1,000 a month rent year one, producing $200 a month in cash flow, and then you raise rents 3% the year two, how much did you raise that monthly rent to? So $1,000 becomes what? What's 30?
Yeah, 1030. So 1030.
You got one hell of a fast smart bit, but you had a difficult time with that one. So $30 jump in your rents would translate to year two having $230 a month in cash flow, correct? Provided we don't have a big jump in taxes. Sure. So it's provided we don't have a big jump in taxes or insurance. So 1,030 becomes 230 in cash flow, which is a 15% compound growth in your cash flow.
Okay.
So when you look at that over the 30 years, if you had the capability to raise rents, every time you raise it 3% and just 3% of the base, where the real power comes is, does the lender get to raise the payment on the loan because of inflation?
No.
No. They have to accept the same $405 a month. Actually, let me see. I've got a chart here that tells me exactly what it is. It would be $417.32 a month for 30 years. So if they're going to accept that exact same $417 a month for 30 years, you start to see that every year, the value of that money continues to decline because of inflation, correct? And if we're factoring at a 7% to be conservative, year 30, that $417.32 is equivalent to the value of $51.42 today because of how it's eroded it. So many people will look at this and say, I'm paying $80,000 principal and paying $70,234 in interest over 30 years. That's $150,234. That's a lot of money that I'm going to be paying for this $80,000 loan. I think I want to pay it off faster. Well, I explained to them, if you take your time, you pay it slowly every month, that $417.32 a month, every month for the next 360 months, you're not paying back $80,000, not paying back the $70,234. The actual cumulative value of those dollars over 30 years is equal, when you compare it to the value of the dollar the day you borrowed the money, it's equal to $62,726. You're never even paying back the principal. That's what the real value of this deal is to use somebody else's money, stretch it over a long period of time, paying them back and never pay back what you even borrowed.
Right. And I think that's the value we find in large scale commercial assets too, that can be underwritten, you know, with agency debt, especially long-term agency debt. It's the same idea.
It's exactly the same idea. You know, and the reason I get really heavy into this, because when you're thinking about a person who's just barely getting started into this, you know, a guy who's, you know, he works in a machine shop and he's coming home at night and just watching the game and wants to spend his weekends, you know, doing something with his kids. He's not thinking, how do I get into an apartment complex with agency debt? I'm thinking, how does he get started? Well, it's easiest to get started with something he knows. He knows what his four walls look like. He knows what people are doing renting down the street. And then he discovers that there's this turnkey thing out there where other people will manage it for you. You literally have a business at your fingertips. It's easier for them to start there, get their 10 loans, and then domino into those larger enterprises. But you got to start somewhere. I love working with the people that's got to get started, right? I like talking with folks who've never done it before and want to understand how can they create something for their future, but don't know where to get going. Getting into the apartment world is daunting. So we give them the baby steps so they can feel confident stepping into that world.
Right. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. What markets do you guys serve?
I'm in 26 markets. So I do a lot in Memphis. I'll probably do about 400 transactions a year in Memphis itself. Then, of course, most of the South and the Midwest, right? Missouri, Indiana, Tennessee, Georgia, the Carolinas, Ohio, Florida, Texas, all over the place. Alabama's got a lot going on. I'm really, really busy in Alabama. Let me just say, I just love working in the South and the Midwest. You know, 1,332 transactions last year. I did 5 in the state of Arizona because I just don't get along with the people here. I live here, but I just don't. I deal with the people in the South and the Midwest, and it's awesome.
Right, right. No, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Aaron, you've given us some great, great things to think about. I love the way you take the numbers and break them down and make it very simple for the starting investor to understand. I think that's very helpful. So I appreciate that. Certainly appreciate that.
Well, those numbers I was quoting off of also was interest rates higher than what we're offering today. So people understand it's not about the rate. That's a consumer thought process. It's about the long-term deal. And when you've got somebody that's in that with you to talk you through, feel confident, and then start looking at what the end should look like, not sitting here staring at what today looks like.
Right, right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's jump here into the final four if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
You really, really get the right people to work with. I don't care what property you buy, honestly. I mean, you definitely have to find one you can keep reasonably rented. But if you don't have a good, solid group of people to work with, you've got nothing. I mean, you could have a solid gold brick house overlooking the bay and never get it rented because your people suck. Or you could have a 8x8 U-Haul box sitting on a street corner. And if you got a great team, they'll keep tenants in that sumbitch. So you've got to get the right people to work with more so than anything.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. What is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
I've got a morning routine. I get up at 4:30 in the morning every single day. I have prayer. I go to my chair and I read certain books every single day. And it was amazing to me how books changed my life. It took a little bit of time for me to figure that out. I was 40 years old before I started cracking books and opening books. And I'm 46. These last six years have compounded my growth of way beyond what the first 40 did. So what I tell everybody is you want to become something, you want things to change in your life, get a predictable start to your day. In my opinion, there's this big ominous foot that wakes up every day at 7:30 and it starts kicking your ass. You need to get up before the foot does and get ahead of it. So I'm already doing stuff 3 hours before the foot wakes up.
That's hysterical. I love that. All right. Very good. Get up before the foot wakes up. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
So I support, have you ever heard of Operation Underground Railroad? Mm-mm. Okay, so the guys, and this is your homework this week, and everybody on here, go to Amazon Prime and look up Operation Toussaint, Toussaint, Operation Toussaint. It is a documentary about a guy who was working for the CIA and then the Homeland Security and got involved in investigating sex trafficking crimes and human trafficking. And he ended up to continue to do what he was doing. He couldn't use government money or government time to do it. Profit. And now he has spec ops guys, former CIA, former FBI working with. They have a large group of people that travel internationally and take down trafficking rings. And they do that with local law enforcement. They're not vigilantes. Well, they have to do it all with all the donations. So I found when I discovered these guys, I need to figure out how do I get to know them? How do I get connected with these folks? So I started campaigning in the sense of $50 of every deal I close goes towards this organization. And then I encourage my clients. I go to my website, aaron.com, scroll down, you'll see the donate button. I think last time I looked, we'd raised $17,000 there. And then I had the opportunity to get connected with this guy. I had dinner with him last week in Utah. And then I took him to an event that I was at, where a bunch of business leaders came together in a room there in Linden, Utah. And we brought him on stage, brought him in. He talked to him. He has two operations going right now, costing about $50,000 per operation to get his people down there. And we raised $119,000 right there in the room. And then people pulled him off the side and started campaigns with their companies. So he's probably had hopefully four of his operations funded just in that one room.
Wow.
So that's really why cool. That's where I try and change the world. You know, the statistics out there are absolutely significantly alarming. From what I understand, there's over 30 million people in some form of slavery today across the globe. You know, everybody knows about the sex trafficking. We're familiar with that, right? So we kind of understand that that's there. There's also, of course, slave for labor. We know that that's out there. What people don't realize is how many thousands or how many millions of people are in slavery for organ harvesting. And then there's, and this one's the shocker that's going to hardly be wrapped around it. There's people being sold for human sacrifice, and they have rescued people in those environments. And it's absolutely amazing to hear the stories and see the pictures. It's gut-wrenching, actually.
Mm, wow. Yeah, that's sobering. That's a lot of sobering. That's a sobering topic, and good for you for doing your part and getting some of those operations funded and doing what you can. That's awesome.
And that's, and you kind of even feel debilitated in that. And that's what I keep talking about is, guys, we do what we do. You, yourself, with your business, and everybody else who's listening to this, even if it's a few bucks, anybody that's able to do that, as long as we are able to continue to make revenue and create things like this, these guys can go in there and keep kicking doors in. You know, that's not something that many people are built to do. We have a hand, we have a people out there that are built for that. So let's do what we're built for to help fuel them to do what they're built for. I think that the world can change if we're all getting behind that. It's nearly a $200 billion a year industry. And he quantified it as you can buy all the Starbucks franchises and every NBA team and still put every kid in the United States into college and have money left over with the amount of money that they draw in every year with that particular type of business.
Wow. Wow. That's wild. Aaron, thanks for doing that. That's awesome. If the listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Just go to my website, aaronchapman.com, or sometimes you might have to throw in aaronbchapman.com if that doesn't work, the middle initial. Sometimes Safari doesn't like it. Also, you can check out my, let me put this here, you can check out my other website. I got a YouTube channel going on, quitjerkingoff.com. So that right is that particular website will be our channel. Our channel is we bring in business leaders from across the country, take them rock crawling, long range shooting, hunting. In fact, we were hunting with Adam Vinatieri just after he retired from the Colts. And then we have that opportunity to get around the campfire at night and have the deep conversation just like you and I are having today.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Aaron, thanks so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you, man.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.